ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us, told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. If someone started having a medical emergency in front of you, I think we'd all hope we'd be the person who'd stay calm and collected and know what to do. Apply pressure to the wound or call for a defibrillator. At the very least, have the wherewithal to dial 000. But what if that medical emergency was a mental health crisis? Would you be confident to step up? The importance of mental health first aid is coming up in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, the rise in fitness companies using AI bodies, promising results that experts, and to be honest, my own eyes, say are impossible. But that doesn't mean it's not easy to get sucked in. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, cast your mind back to the school library of your childhood. What do you remember? I remember a long stuffed rainbow serpent that we could all sit against while someone read a story. And then when I got a bit older, I discovered the most efficient route to get straight to the bookshelf that held all of Emily Rodder's classics. And whether your school library is a one-room demountable or a state-of-the-art facility, it's where so many of us first develop a love of reading, which then flows onto all sorts of skills that we need as we grow up. But it might surprise you to discover that actually a lot of schools don't have a dedicated library or the right staff to run them. There was a recent census in South Australia that showed only 15% of schools in that state have a qualified teacher librarian, and that figure's actually gone down in the last 5 years. And this sits against declining rates of reading among younger generations generally, which begs the question, if kids aren't being immersed in literature at school, what do they go on to miss later on in life? Well, you're about to hear from one of Australia's most beloved and funniest children's authors on this and from librarians on the ground, but I really want to hear from you too. What's the book your school librarian put you onto? What did that book do for you? I would love to hear the story of the story that your school librarian put you onto. And here with me is Kathy Warburton, who's the CEO of the Australian Library and Information Association. Kathy, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you've been writing about this recently for the Sydney Morning Herald. I was really surprised to learn that so many schools don't have a library. What's behind this here?
Well, basically, I agree. It is shocking. And anyone I tell is shocked, as they should be. It used to be back in the 70s and 80s, it was mandated in various jurisdictions around Australia. But then it was decentralised or devolved to principals to make the decision, and it's not mandated. So, of course, principals have a very difficult decision about how do they spend their money, and unfortunately, not enough of them are actually choosing for it to be spent on the library, and they might be choosing music or art or something else instead. But we say, no, a library is really an essential part of a school. Private schools, Catholic schools know that, and they're pretty good with having them, but the public schools are really being left behind, some of them, not all of them, but that's the problem.
Do we know how many schools don't have libraries?
I wish we did, and that's what we're working towards, but unfortunately, you know, what you measure matters, and this is not being measured. So we've written to all the state departments of education and the ministers for education to ask them, can you please tell us, of all your independent Catholic and public schools, how many of them have a library and how many of those have qualified staff? And they can't tell us.
So you said, when you sort of rattled off things like music and art, I was like, well, I want schools to have those things too. Why do you think, I'm obviously asking the head of the Library Association, but what is it about libraries that is essential in your mind?
Well, I think for libraries, they're there for not only the students in terms of supporting the curriculum that's being taught, but also, as you mentioned in your introduction, the love of reading and being immersed in that and those wonders and the lifelong benefits of that. But they're also there for all of the teachers. So they're actually there for every single subject. They support art, they support music, because they've got the resources that can help teacher prepare for their classes, and they're there for the whole school in terms of the culture of the school, any priorities of the school. So to me, they're really the heart of a school, and therefore support everything, teacher, students, community.
Do we know what the difference is in outcomes if you're a kid that goes to a school with a library versus one that doesn't have a library?
There is some research which was done by the Australian Council for Educational Research, which actually looked at the results where a school has a qualified teacher librarian compared to those that don't, and the NAPLAN results are higher in a school that has a teacher librarian with a library. So there is that evidence, and but also we know anecdotally just the benefits for schools that have that library and the results for teachers as well. So once again, we need more research in the area to show this, but we absolutely do have hard facts that actually student outcomes are improved.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to Cathy Warburton, who's the CEO of the Australian Library and Information Association, about the fact that it's not mandatory for schools to have school libraries. We don't know how many schools don't have them because it's not data that we track. And Cathy says both of those things need to change. I'm asking you about the book that your teacher librarian maybe put you onto when you were at school, or if there's a book from your childhood that's really stuck with you that maybe you discovered in a school library. A message here, Cathy, that I think is going to make you want to tear your hair out. This person says, in year six, I was made library monitor with another girl who was quite willing to be 2IC. I decided the books were out of order and needed to be rearranged, and it didn't occur to me that we could start at one end and pull out the misplaced books one by one. So one lunchtime at the end of term, my friend and I pulled all the books off all the shelves and dumped them on the reading table in the middle. The teacher dropped by when the bell rang, and I still remember the look of horror on her face at the jumble and chaos confronting her. This text says, 55 years later, I wonder whether they're still sorting out the mess. I would love to hear your school library story. Also with me, a fixture in school libraries, best-selling author and Australian Children's Laureate, Andy Griffiths. Andy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Tell me about your high school librarian, Mrs. Woolmer, am I right?
Mrs. Woolmer, who had the amazing insight and purpose. She had the brilliance to put books that you would not expect kids to want to read. And the first book I found on the first day of year seven was called 13 Ways to Dispose of a Body. And I still remember the tagline. It said, the murder is the easy part. It's getting rid of the body where the problems really start. Now, I was in. I was like, came from Enid Blyton. I was like, okay, bring on the adult world. And what you think as an adult may be, you know, suitable for a kid is not always what the kid wants. And Mrs. Woolmer knew that.
I do think quietly that Enid Blyton would have known how to dispose of a body. I just feel like she had that kind of imagination.
She certainly knew how to get you to turn the pages and give you that feeling, that expansive feeling that you didn't know what was going to happen next, that anything could happen. And it made me thirsty for more imaginative experiences. And I think that's what we're talking about here, is growing the imagination, which benefits you across every possible subject and also your life happiness and possibilities that you imagine for yourself.
Andy, you must come across kids who have discovered you in their school library. Do they tell you these stories?
Yes. Yeah. I've been around for much longer than I ever expected to. I thought I'd have a few years in the sun, but it's been almost 30 years. And a number of my early just readers are now librarians themselves. And they, you know, I love meeting them. And I can see they're alive. They know it from the inside, how exciting and how much a book can add to your life in intangible ways. And I think that's partly why a principal, when weighing up, you know, one thing against another, might think, well, I can't really quantify imagination. But we all know that's where the real juice in life is. And I'm thrilled that those librarians who have been turned on to the power of books by me, and I'm just passing on the feeling I used to get from the authors I loved, I think their children are really lucky because they are just going to transmit that enthusiasm, you know, without a lecture about reading, why it's good for you.
Oh, go on. Give us a lecture. Oh, no, sorry, I see what you're saying. But you say that, you argue that reading sets kids up for so much more. What do you mean by that?
I mean, it expands your imagination, and not just for fun and the pleasure of a fantasy world, but for your own world. You know, how well can you imagine the rest of your life? And, you know, that question, what are you going to do when you leave school? Well, if you haven't exercised your imagination, there doesn't seem to be a lot of avenues to you. And I'd say, as an employer, what you want is an employee who can imagine possibilities and value add to your business. We want creative, you know, bold thinkers. And that's what reading does for you.
Absolutely. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Andy Griffiths, best-selling children's author and the 26-27 Children's Laureate, and Kathy Warburton, who's the CEO of the Australian Library and Information Association, talking about the need for mandating that schools have libraries, understanding where the libraries are in Australia so that we can, address some of the inequalities in the system. I'd love to hear from you about the book that maybe your librarian put you onto, or what the library gave to you as a kid. My number is 0418-226-576. Lots of texts on this. One person says, in 1961, my primary school librarian suggested I read Mike Marr's Astronaut. It was the first book I ever read. Another says, my kids go to a private school in southern New South Wales and they got rid of a dedicated junior school library despite there being a library fund in the fees. They've now created a small library space, but kids can't go in there at lunchtime and it's very small, though they've built a gym, a new car park, and expanded boarding rooms to get more fees in the door. Louise says, my granddaughter had to change schools in primary school. She was late in the year to fit in, so she hung out in her school library, was guided by the teacher librarian in her borrowing, and has become an avid reader while now well integrated with her new schoolmates. Well, someone who is on the coalface of this as a school librarian is Hanalka Malloy, who is coordinating a grassroots campaign called Students Need School Libraries. Hanalka, just absolutely putting up front there what you're all about with that name for your campaign.
Well, I think the name of the campaign says it all. Thank you.
Absolutely. So one of the big parts of the problem is the lack of data on school libraries. You're in South Australia. What's happening in that state?
So we did commission the Australian Council for Educational Research to undertake a census into the staffing and the impact of school libraries for all schools in South Australia across government, public and private and independent schools, and looked at what made up the staffing in a school library. So looking at the number of teacher librarians, looking at the number of librarians, library assistants, library technicians and all the roles that help make school libraries the magical space they are. And we have, as you mentioned earlier, we found that at the moment, there are less than 15% of schools in South Australia have a dual qualified teacher librarian, and most of our school libraries are staffed by people who have not been provided with the opportunities to undertake the sort of training and qualifications they need to support them with the information science required behind library management, and giving them that extra support to help lead a library and develop its library collections. So their work, these people are working in school libraries, doing an amazing job and putting in countless hours, often voluntary hours, and working with tremendous passion and dedication to help connect students with the books they enjoy. But they don't necessarily have the teaching background or the library science background needed to teach media literacy and information literacy to students.
Can you talk a bit more about that? Without getting too weedy, what is this skill set that a teacher librarian has that's so unique?
It's the information science side of it, so, and the teaching side, of course. So teaching students how to determine source credibility, how to apply lateral reading skills, how to sort through misinformation and disinformation, and how to use information and technology such as AI ethically and safely, and all the ways they can find information both digitally and physically.
Kathy, you argue that without qualified staff, it's not a fully functioning school library. What is this sort of magic between the place and the people?
Well, I think a room just with books which is not curated, which is not supported for the community it needs, is just that, a room full of books which doesn't come alive. I think the qualified staff actually are there. They know their community, their school community. They work with the teachers to bring those resources alive, but they also spend time with students, either in teaching programs around media literacy or information literacy or research, but they spend time with them also, as Andy was saying, to, you know, suggest books, to suggest this is what you might like to read, but also to display the collection so that, you know, kids can actually browse and go through there at lunchtime or whatever and find their own books. Because we know from research with Australia Reads, for example, that if kids are able to choose a book themselves, that actually already gives it a head start for them in terms of their love of reading. And so it's giving that space, but you need to model a space and have the available resources if it's actually going to be there for students. Just a room full of books won't do it. And it really is that, I suppose, that interest and understanding of the school community that a teacher librarian then connects the students with the resources, the teachers with the resources, and it's just sort of this beautiful circle.
A lot of love on the text line, not just for libraries, but for teacher librarians specifically, you'll be happy to hear. Patty says, I think the issue of libraries in schools comes down to a lack of awareness of the specialised skills of teacher librarians. I spoke with a friend who is in the process of choosing a school. I was horrified that he was considering a school without a library. His solution was parents could perhaps set one up. I think the logic was that if you just provide a bunch of books, it will all be okay. He clearly didn't understand the role of teacher librarians in teaching digital literacy, creating collections that meet the needs of students, managing those collections, and being a source of expertise within the school community. When funds are short, libraries are often seen as a source of savings. This is short-sighted and wrong. They are instead a critical part of effective education. Andy, from an author's perspective, what's the special source of a teacher librarian?
I would say, having visited probably thousands of schools over the last 30 years, I can tell instantly whether that school is alive, and it will usually be due to the librarian having arranged a visit, and not just arranged a visit, but having whipped the kids up into an enthusiastic frenzy over weeks ahead of the visit to really get them excited and connect books with the real world, with real people who write them. And, you know, I owe my career to librarians, because that's how I made my living in the early years, was visiting schools and doing talks and workshops. And not just from the kids' point of view, but from my point of view, I was getting to spend a lot of time with kids and really zero in on what they love and what they respond to in my own particular writing. So, yeah, I salute any teacher librarian, and I can only, feel sorry for schools that don't have a library or someone who knows how to sort from the blizzard of books that are out there how to take the right book and put it in the right kid's hand at the right time.
So, Kathy, it feels like we're all in furious agreement here, you, me, Anelka, Andy, and every single person who's texting me these beautiful novels on the text line about the importance of school libraries and teacher librarians. What would it take to make it mandatory? What would it cost to raise the bar across Australia?
Well, we're doing some further work into that. So I think, I mean, what we would like as number one is to actually get it measured. So call out to anyone working in a Department of Education or a Minister for Education's office. We really would like to get a survey up and running. We're happy to do the legwork, but, you know, it takes money, which we don't have. So we'd really like to get the stats. So as you said, we can focus in on those areas or those states which are particularly lagging behind. And it's all about the kids, to make sure those kids aren't left behind and are supported as they should be. And then secondly, once we know what the landscape is, then we really want to be able to, I suppose, have legislation ultimately, which makes it a requirement, just not just a guideline or a suggestion or nice to have. And legislation that is enforced. Now, the cost of it, that's some research we're going to do to actually identify exactly how much that would cost, you know, for a school and different size populations, et cetera. So that's something we're going to work on. So we've got those figures. The thing is, we know there's only a limited number of dollars out there. It doesn't happen to suddenly magically appear. So sometimes it'll have to be making choices. And that's another role for our advocacy, is really at this stage, most of the power or the ability to decide how the money is spent is with principals. So we really need to, I suppose, educate the principals to say, look, when you're making these choices, it's sort of a no-brainer that the best investment is in a school library because of all these reasons. So that's the work we need to do, but it would be great to have the politicians and the state departments of education behind us on that.
Well, Kathy, Andy, Hanaka, thank you all so much for joining me today. Kathy Warburton is CEO at the Australian Library and Information Association. Andy Griffiths, a best-selling author and the 2026-27 Children's Laureate. And Hanaka Malloy is president of the School Library Association of South Australia and coordinator of a grassroots campaign called Students Need School Libraries. And thank you for your shout-outs on the text line, people shouting out their favourite librarian from the years. One person wanted to give a shout out to Miss Underwood, an exceptional teacher librarian at Toowoomba East State School in the 1970s, chose Beowulf as a feature display. It opened a new world to me as a student. It was inspiring, setting our imaginations running and establishing a theme through our art and English classes. Another says a big shout out to the wonderful Barbara Nicholson, the legendary teacher librarian at Birch Grove Public School during 40 years ago. Parents and students looked forward to her book discussions and recommendations each week. And Katie says, my mum was our school librarian. Shout out to Jen in Roselle. She was amazing, especially given we lived in the outback mining Western Australia with a high Indigenous population. Katie says, I can't believe we had a library in hindsight. I remember the strip film projector showing the book Ping, which I suppose means I should shout out my own teacher librarian from my primary school years, Miss Davey, if you're listening. Thank you. Well, coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, if someone had a mental health episode at your work or at the park or at your kid's soccer game, would you know how to help them?
I'm Peter Martin, host of The Economy Stupid, where we find economics in relationships.
She only wants a man if he's really, really good.
In the Reserve Bank board.
I knew. Everybody on the board knew recession was coming.
And in food.
It's about the cup of diesels required through the life cycle to get that chicken patty on your burger.
The Economy Stupid, Thursdays 5:30 p.m. on ABC Radio National or anytime on ABC Listen.
If someone went into cardiac arrest in front of me, I'd like to think I'd know how to spring into action, yell out for a defibrillator, dial 000, start chest compressions to the tempo of Staying Alive by the Bee Gees. Fun fact, it also works if you do it to the Queen song, Another One Bites the Dust. But a mental health crisis? I'm not confident I could spot one happening next to me. Because when it comes to mental injuries, you don't always know what you're looking at. You can never really know what's going on inside someone else's head. And when an AFL player had an on-field episode a few weeks ago, There were countless people nearby who could have spotted and treated a physical injury, but the response to a mental health issue wasn't clear in the heat of the moment. So in the aftermath, the AFL have implemented a new rule. All clubs must have an in-house psychologist to keep an eye on players' mental fitness. So if that footy field was your office, could you spot the signs and know what the right next step would be to keep the people around you mentally safe? I'd love to know from you today what your mental health literacy is like. If someone had a crisis, could you spot the signs and help them? How did you learn these skills? Here with me is Jackie Barnfield from Mental Health First Aid Australia, who teaches these skills to people across the country. Jackie, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for having me this morning.
What do we know about how common mental health first aid skills are in Australia?
Amazingly, we've done really well with training up a significant proportion of the community. So we've got over 1.6 million people trained across the country over a period of about 25 years. Where that those people are is something that we're not entirely sure of. There's lots of organisations, lots of businesses that are training up their employees, which is great because, of course, people don't just live at work. They're not just a singular employee. So being able to take those mental health first aid skills out into their home life, into their sporting events, into with their friends, really useful investments out into our communities.
What does it look like in practice? Is it similar to physical first aid?
It's very similar in a way that the mental health first aid training really does provide practical, evidence-based skills to recognise, respond to and support someone, which is very similar to the physical first aid approach. And very much like physical first aid with the doctor's ABCD even now, mental health first aid also has an action plan that makes the steps of following first aid really just as simple and easy to follow.
We will get into some of those step-by-steps in a little while. I'm interested to sort of know whether maybe it's an easier conversation to have these days than it would have been, say, a decade or so ago. It feels like the stigma around mental health is starting to be dismantled in a way that it wasn't a decade ago.
For sure. And broadly, Australia's done a massive amount of work on awareness campaigns around mental health. That really matters, and people are having the conversations. But awareness doesn't give people the skills to respond. And that's where we're thinking that mental health first aid steps in, being able to have really robust conversations with someone to be able to support them in the same way as you would with, again, back to a physical injury.
Just like what kind of signs are you looking for in a person? So, okay, physical first aid, if someone is lying on the ground unresponsive, you're like, this person is having a physical problem and I might need to apply first aid. It's much less clear with mental health first aid. What sort of things are you looking for?
Yeah, I think it's important to know that it might be something that you can know really well if you know the person really well. It might be not as obvious if it's someone that you don't necessarily know. So that's something to keep in mind. But really, mental health problems or crises can look different for everyone. And you're right, there are warning signs. Things like noticeable changes in behaviour or mood, perhaps a withdrawal or a disconnection. Someone might present in what might be a heightened distress, maybe looking a bit agitated or teary, some emotional overwhelm. In the workplace, it could be too that they're having difficulty concentrating or appearing to have difficulty in coping. And for someone at home, you know, recognising changes in communication, whether it be in sleep as well, but also in performance or relationships.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking with Jackie Barnfield, who's the Executive Director of International Programs Quality and Research at Mental Health First Aid Australia, talking about this idea of applying mental health first aid if you saw someone who might need it. If this is something that you've experienced, I'd love to know how you develop the skills to know what to do. Also here with me is Dr. Courtney Walton, who's a research fellow at the University of Melbourne and registered sport and exercise psychologist. Courtney, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks for having me.
Part of the reason why this is a timely chat is because of what we saw a few weeks ago, our Carlton player Elijah Holland having an on-field mental health episode that was kind of missed at the time. Courtney, would you have known what was going on if you were looking at that player?
That's a really hard one to answer. I think one of the key things that Jackie actually just mentioned is having the awareness of an individual person and actually being able to know that person well, understand what's going on for them in the broader kind of their broader background. And so I think that's where some of the challenges and risks come of kind of people from the outside trying to assume or recognize what actually might be going on in that case.
Fair enough. We're not going to be forcing you to be an armchair expert. That's not very fair. I suppose what I was wondering about is just that ability to recognize when something's not right with someone and how to kind of develop those skills if that's not something you've ever really had to think about a lot before.
Yeah, and I think that is where we can certainly do a lot of work in places like professional sport and other workplaces to try and upskill more people in the organisation to be able to potentially recognise maybe when there is signs or signals that we need to bring someone in to provide some support. That's certainly not placing the emphasis on people beyond the medical team or psychologist to actually be intervening necessarily or providing treatment, but more the kind of recognition that maybe something's not quite right and needs kind of escalation.
So we've got this new rule with the AFL saying all clubs must now have an in-house psychologist to keep an eye on players' mental fitness. Is this a big step for the AFL? Like we were talking before about, especially in sport, up until pretty recently, mental health was pretty stigmatized, Courtney.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. There's the amount of change that's happened in the last decade in terms of the increased not only awareness but acceptance and genuine kind of efforts to try and enhance what we do to recognize and support and manage athletes' mental health. Probably in the past, there's been more of a focus on simply maximizing performance and less attention paid to the actual individual and their well-being. So things like this are fantastic for really making sure we're doing everything we can to support athletes. And also I'd add people like coaches and others in those sports environments.
It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Courtney Walton from the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences at UniMelb and with Jackie Barnfield from Mental Health First Aid Australia about whether you'd know what to do if you saw someone having a mental health emergency. My number is 0418 226 576. Kelly says, I tried to find mental health first aid training as a private individual, that is not through work, a few years ago in the Canberra area. It wasn't available. I was interested because there were a lot of teenagers around with my kids' friends and many were struggling. They've grown up now, but is it possible for people to access this training just as people in the community? Jackie?
Absolutely. We've got a great website of mentalhealthfirstaid.com.au where people can access and find courses right the way around the country.
So let's talk about some 101s. You sort of hinted before, Jackie, about what the process is that in the similar way that we've got Dr. ABC, if you're doing physical first aid, and I do recommend that you look that up and refresh your memory because you never know when you might need it. What is the process for mental health first aid?
So our action plan, like I said before, Doctors ABC, LG. So approach the person, assess and assist with any crisis. So it's really about knowing that you should actually be having a conversation. The L refers to listen and communicate non-judgmentally. And, of course, that's really important. You said before that, stigma reduction and people talking about mental health increased over time. This is really key. And part of it is about making sure that we set aside any judgments that we might have about what a person's experiencing. G is about then giving the support and information, acknowledging that what you've seen, but also saying it's not uncommon. Lots of people experience mental health problems every single day and recognising what it is that you've done. The E, the first E, is encourage the person to get appropriate professional help. And what's really great too is obviously we've got this amazing investment. The Australian government's significantly invested in the Medicare mental health walk-in centres. And it's brilliant having them available in the community, but it's really important that we're able to make use of them by getting people there early. So aligning what we have in our community with what is on offer and available is really key. And then the second E is around encouraging other supports. And that's things like your own self-care. What do you do? How do you look after yourself?
So at work, it's often mandated to have at least one or two people who are qualified first aiders. Should this be broadened out to mental health first aid as well?
I would love that to be the case. As you pointed out before, you don't know whether someone is going to have a physical injury in front of you. Much the same way as a mental health problem could occur in the workplace at any time. Being able to have supports around constantly in the workplace to be able to step in, have a conversation, be a resource would be ideal. I would certainly advocate for having mental health first aiders in every workplace.
I mean, Jackie, of course, you're going to say that you run training for mental health first aid. Fair enough. Courtney, what about in other contexts like community sports? Do you think having mandated mental health first aid is a useful thing?
Yeah, I think so. I'm always kind of wary of how many things are placed on, particularly places like community sports, where there's all sorts of trainings and so on that coaches need to do. But I do think this is a really important one. And we've been speaking with coaches very recently about this and just the kind of lack of understanding and knowledge around what do I do when this shows up with a young person I'm working with can be really challenging. So I think anytime we're trying to help people with a few more skills, a little bit more knowledge is really valuable.
A text here saying, I did the mental health first aid course and learnt it's different to psychological first aid, the latter useful in the short term after an emergency. Briefly, Jackie, what is the difference there?
Psychological first aid is, as it was just pointed out, is about that short-term, immediate response to what has been potentially a crisis or a traumatic event. Everyone experiences mental health, and so mental health first aid is much more of a continuum that we transition in and out of, and as we're experiencing different experiences every single day, our mental health changes. And so being able to recognise and reflect on that is what mental health first aid helps to support in the long term.
Jackie, Courtney, thank you both so much. Dr. Courtney Walton is a Senior Research Fellow at the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne and a registered sport and exercise psychologist. Jackie Barnfield is the Executive Director of International Programs, Quality and Research at Mental Health First Aid Australia. And thank you for your texts too. One person says, the primary difference between physical and mental health first aid is whether the person suffering is open to accepting help. With a broken leg, heart attack, or gushing wound, most people want help. When a person is depressed or over anxious or manic, sometimes people aren't ready to engage and resist. I have done mental health first aid training with registered trainers through work. I've been in a position several times where I had to use the skills, listening without judgment, gauging what kind of supports might already be available to the person, and giving information about possible next steps helped in those instances. Well, this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, when the fitness before and after ads you're seeing are literally too good to be true. Advertising shows us what we want, right? The life we should be living, the holiday we need to take, the body we should have. And most of the time you can tell if the sales pitch is too good to be true, but in some cases what we're being sold is literally impossible. There's been a BBC investigation that's revealed a trend in fitness companies using AI-generated people to sell their programs, promising results in 28 days with physiques that are quite literally unreal. And you might think of yourself as a savvy consumer, but with AI becoming more sophisticated and the idea of looking fit being so tempting, anyone can get sucked in. So how do you keep your guard up? I'm about to get into it with our resident consumer behaviour expert. But tell me how you feel when you see a before and after image, whether it's AI or real. Does it make you feel motivated? Does it make you feel a little uncomfortable? Here with me, Dr. Paul Harrison, Head of Consumer Behaviour at Deakin University. He joins me fortnightly for our segment, Buyer Beware. On a scale of 1 to 10, how buff are you feeling today, Paul?
Oh, dear. 11 and a half.
of course. Your AI-generated self is speaking to me right now.
I'm completely AI-generated, exactly.
When you see these stories on AI-generated fitness influencers, what's your kind of toned gut reaction?
I think it's just a continuation of, I don't know, when I see these things, it's weird. I think, yep, I get it. It makes sense and I can see why people fall for it. And I think that's my normal gut reaction to all of this kind of stuff. It's like, you know, you have this worry about the human condition, but then you go, yeah, but I understand why people fall for these things. And, you know, one of the big ones is just the fact that, you know, we all are striving to be wanted, to be liked. And all this does is it says to us, if you do these things, you'll be popular, you'll be likable, you'll be attractive, people will want to be with you. And I think that's the thing that's sitting underneath all of this.
Do we know that it works? Like, how do we know that this sort of advertising is cutting through?
Oh, I think that particularly with AI and particularly with online and social media, it's not really about, because it's just so easy to generate and it can be broadcast to huge numbers of people, it does have an effect. Usually on people who are feeling a little bit uncomfortable with their current situation, feeling a little bit like, oh, I need to find this kind of gap between this ideal self and the actual self that I really am. I think all of these things kind of feed into it. And it's more about, there's enough people who will react to this that will fall for this, that there is harm being caused. And, you know, in the end, the content being generated, particularly with AI, is very cheap to make, and it's pretty cheap to kind of put on social media. So it's effective.
I think a lot of people think they know when they're seeing AI, but kind of by definition, if you don't recognize it, then you don't know it. Like, you're not going to sort of file that into the AI part of your brain if you don't realize that what you're looking at is AI, because it's getting so much better.
Yeah, and I think that's the issue, is that we like to think that we can pick up AI, but as you say, it's really difficult at the moment. And, you know, sometimes people will think something is AI and it's not, and other times they'll think it is an AI and it is. And there's been some interesting studies that have kind of found that, is that people are incredibly confident that something is AI, even people who develop AI. And I've seen some videos of these people going, yeah, definitely AI. And then they walk away, they go, no, that's a real human. And I think this is the difficulty that we're grappling with right now.
Why body transformation? What is it about? This trope has been around for as long as I have been consuming fitness content, which is decades now, I'm ashamed to admit. Mm. What is it about this before and after that tickles a part of our brain like this?
Well, you and I have talked about this in the past. We talked about self-discrepancy theory, this idea between the actual, well, what we're trying to do is find that gap between the actual self and the ideal self. I think fitness is one of those things. It's a feeling of control. So if we feel like we can get in control of our fitness, we're going to avoid sickness, we're going to avoid being, you know, hurting ourselves, all of these kinds of things. And so these before and afters, you know, ultimately, and we know this as consumers, we know that they're not real. We know that these are constructed, but we are also creatures that have evolved to believe. So in a way, we like to kind of think that we are these kind of, I don't know, skeptical creatures who sometimes get fooled. But in reality, what we are is that we're trusting creatures who every now and then manage to be skeptical. And that's the problem, is that we see an image and we think, yeah, you know, like, that's not going to be me, but a version of me. It's why vitamins work. It's why quick fixes work. It's why scams work. It's because it's given to us in a way that is quick and convenient, and we ultimately do want to believe that it's possible.
So even non-AI Fitspo, fitness inspiration, can be problematic. On the Health Report last week, Dr. Priya Alexander and Belinda Smith were talking about a recent study from Northwestern University in the US showing that Fitspo can have serious negative effects on young people's body image. And actually, if you want to watch a video of Priya and Belle having this conversation, they're wearing Bluey and Bingo costumes. You can find that on Radio National socials, or you can find the Health Report on ABC Listen, shameless plug. But I'm interested, Paul, to talk about the fact that this is like non-AI Fitspo being harmful. Does the AI side of things magnify the potential harm? Does it play into this at all?
It does. I mean, with Fitspo, I actually did a study about 10 years ago with Laura McVee on the same kind of thing. Again, looking at, you know, women, the way women were influenced by Fitspo. And I think it sits underneath basically pre-existing needs of what it is to be human. So, like I was saying, belonging, self-improvement, social comparison, all of those things. And all that happens is that AI makes that more efficient. And, you know, the better way to think about this is that all that AI and technology as it advances is it's just an optimized response to a demand that actually has been there since the beginning of kind of human evolution, which is this constant desire to, first of all, be in control, but second, to kind of compare ourselves to others and say, if that person is going to be like this, maybe I can be like that as well. And I think these are all things that marketers know inherently. They may not be able to use the terms that I use. I often have marketers in my class and they go, that's not what we call it. And I go, yeah, but it is what the theory is. And I think this is the thing, is that these things exist because they're actually useful for us. You know, being able to compare ourselves to others helps us to work out how we belong to a group. But they can also have those negative consequences as well, which is ultimately that we are being sold something that perhaps we can't achieve.
Yeah, the mental health side of thing is this feeling of dissatisfaction that you feel like you're not where you're meant to be. I guess that dissonance, as you were saying before.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that really ultimately has happened is that every time we have some new wave of media, whether it was print or radio or television and now social media, we get these anxieties and they are a concern. And I think when people ask me, and I was talking to somebody recently about scams, I was thinking, I don't think it's an easy, quick fix. I don't think it's one thing like education or getting people to be more skeptical or anything like that. I think it has to be a combination of things. And the first thing that we have to just hold on to is this idea that most people are susceptible to being manipulated in some form, and businesses actually have that knowledge and the capacity to do that. The individual does not. And I think one of the things I often talk to regulators about is this idea of we put too much pressure back on the individual to take responsibility for their choices rather than all of the other institutions that are kind of out there to some degree to take advantage of those particular abilities to be manipulated.
But I also think if you're a consumer that thinks of yourself as being too savvy to get sucked in, that that it's only gullible people that get sucked in, that you're never going to push for that regulation either because you maybe think it's not necessary.
Until you get sucked in. And I think that's the thing. Until it directly affects you, most people don't really understand something until it has it. And we all know that when we have an experience of feeling a sense of unfairness or something, we actually go, yeah, that's unfair. One of the issues that I've noticed over my time is that what we don't do very well, and we don't do this in regulation either, is that we don't transfer the context to the concept. So what we do is we say there's a problem here in the digital space or in the banking space or in the whatever space, but we say there's a bigger underlying issue here, which is how humans behave. And somehow, if we're going to legislate, if we're going to educate, if we're going to help people make better decisions, we have to look at that conceptual level, not necessarily at each individual contextual level, whatever that might be.
What would effective regulation look like if we're talking specifically about AI FITSPO influencers?
It's just really hard. I think one good example in a way is the Australian Consumer Law, which was probably built around this idea of moving beyond the caveat emptor concept, the buyer beware. There you go. There's our topic. and it takes the responsibility totally away from the consumer, because that's really how consumer laws generally operate, which is that, you know, a consumer has to make these decisions if they sign a terms and conditions, those kinds of things. I think even, you know, unfair contract terms is a good example of that, which is to say when a contract itself is unfair, even if the consumer signed it, it may be able to be questioned. It may be able to be challenged. I think laws that and regulation that kind of look at the reality of the human experience. And I think the court system is not set up for that. The court system, this is the frustrating thing for me as a consumer behaviour. Whenever I'm an expert witness in a case, they all go, so what would the typical consumer be? And I go, who's the typical consumer? Mm. Like, there is no such thing as a typical consumer. And I think that's the difficulty, is that we're looking for generalities, and in reality what we should be thinking about is, where is the risk? Because it's actually good for people to take risks. I think that's a good thing. But where is the risk, and who's the vulnerable, and how do we intervene for the people who are most vulnerable?
Well, nothing typical about you, Paul. Thank you as always for chatting with me.
Thanks, Tegan.
Dr. Paul Harrison is Head of Consumer Behaviour at Deakin University. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Well, early in the show, we unpacked something that came as a big shock to me, the fact that a lot of schools don't have a dedicated library or the right staff to run them. And you heard from bestselling author and Australian Children's Laureate Andy Griffiths, who really knows the importance of a school library and the skilled teacher librarians who run them. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
I would say, having visited probably thousands of schools over the last 30 years, I can tell instantly whether that school is alive, and it will usually be due to the librarian having arranged a visit, and not just arranged a visit, but having whipped the kids up into an enthusiastic frenzy over weeks ahead of the visit to really get them excited and connect books with the real world, with real people who write them. And, you know, I owe my career to librarians because that's how I made my living in the early years, was visiting schools and doing talks and workshops. And not just from the kids' point of view, but from my point of view, I was getting to spend a lot of time with kids and really zero in on what they love and what they respond to in my own particular writing. So, yeah, I salute any teacher librarian, and I can only, you know, feel sorry for schools that don't have a library or someone who knows how to sort from the blizzard of books that are out there, how to take the right book and put it in the right kid's hand at the right time.
And Kathy Warburton, who's the CEO of the Australian Library and Information Association, also had a few ideas on how we can get more libraries into schools.
What we would like as number one is to actually get it measured. So call out to anyone working in a Department of Education or a Minister for Education's office. We really would like to get a survey up and running. We're happy to do the legwork, but, you know, it takes money, which we don't have. So we'd really like to get the stats. So as you said, we can focus in on those areas or those states which are particularly lagging behind. And it's all about the kids, to make sure those kids aren't left behind and are supported as they should be. And then secondly, once we know what the landscape is, then we really want to be able to, I suppose, have legislation ultimately, which makes it a requirement, just not just a guideline or a suggestion or nice to have, and legislation that is enforced. Now, the cost of it, that's some research we're going to do to actually identify exactly how much that would cost, you know, for a school and different size populations, et cetera. So that's something we're going to work on. So we've got those figures. The thing is, we know there's only a limited number of dollars out there. It doesn't happen to suddenly magically appear. So sometimes it'll have to be making choices. And that's another role for our advocacy, is really at this stage, most of the power or the ability to decide how the money is spent is with principals. So we really need to, I suppose, educate the principals to say, look, when you're making these choices, it's sort of a no-brainer that the best investment is in a school library because of all these reasons. So that's the work we need to do, but it would be great to have the politicians and the state departments of education behind us on that.
That is Kathy Warburton, CEO of the Australian Library and Information Association, and best-selling children's author Andy Griffiths, chatting to me earlier in the show about the importance of school libraries. They're not a given, depending on where you live in Australia. I do recommend going back and listening to that full chat if you have time. It was just delightful, honestly, and very inspiring. It inspired you to send me a lot of texts. Kerry says, as a former principal in a large government school in Melbourne's western suburbs, I was so proud of our beautiful, vibrant library that was always filled with young people and our dedicated teacher librarians. It was an investment that was visible and gave back every day. We cannot discuss this without considering the fact that government schools, especially in Victoria, are still not adequately funded. Another says, you wouldn't go to a health centre without qualified medical staff. A school library is similar. Many principals aren't great readers and don't understand the value of reading. There's so much money spent on providing computers in schools, and there's no evidence that these improve literacy. Another says, I was a voracious reader, but the books that turned me on from the age of 8 and led to a lifetime of reading were not allowed in the school and suburban libraries. Enid Blyton and her focus on adventure and heroes were thought to be not good quality or meaningful, yet they started my lifetime love of reading. I can't believe that Enid Blyton wasn't allowed in your school library. What a sad loss. Rod says, I was in primary school in the tiny town of Lilydale, Tasmania in the early 1980s. The town library was a small room in the Memorial Hall that only opened for a few hours each week. One of my favourite memories is Dad taking my two brothers and I there on a Friday night in our pyjamas to pick out the week's books, mostly Asterix comics, I believe. Well, that is just about it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal land, but I will be back with you again tomorrow because tonight the government will reveal its budget and it's expected to include some big changes, especially if you are retired or getting close to retirement. So tomorrow I'll give you a breakdown of what the budget means for older Australians. You'll also hear about modern dating from the host of Triple J's The Hookup, who has a brand new book out about this, and singing in the workplace, which is something I do often without the consent of my colleagues, but you'll hear from someone who is all about the mental health benefits that can come from doing it in a slightly more organised fashion. That's all coming up for you tomorrow on Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.